financial literacy, and the human condition. Welcome to Financial Fitness with the Money Doctor, Dr. Francis Rahm.
Welcome to Financial Fitness. I'm Jess Tyler, along with the Money Doctor, Dr. Francis Rahm. Good morning.
Good morning, Jess. How are you?
I'm good. I'm looking forward to this show because it's our question show.
So I'm looking forward to these questions.
All right, let's start off with David. He, and this is kind of a general question. He wants to know, what is the best long-term investment?
David, wow. Okay. Well, let me just pick one. So you know what I'm going to say. It would be better for me if I knew anything more about David, how old he is, what his goals are, all of that. Best is a relative term. The best long-term investment for one person may not be for another.
Maybe we could break it down to like if you were in your 20s and 30s versus if you're in your 40s and 50s.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. Is I hate to, you know, give these sort of double talk answers when I'm really trying to give you information. So with my disclaimer that this is not investment advice, since I don't really know anything about David, I'll give you some general parameters. Long-term investments in general, when you say the best long-term investment, if he's young, he may be thinking about, you know, I can tolerate some risk. So would my best long-term investment be stocks? Would it be mutual funds? So if he's very young, he might be able to tolerate some risk, you know, 20s to 30s, that sort of age group can certainly tolerate some risk. Doesn't mean you have to take it, right? But it means you can tolerate it. In other words, you can maybe invest in a well-diversified stock portfolio or a group of mutual funds, which by their very nature are already diversified. If you don't know what a mutual fund is, if you think, well, it's a Fidelity mutual fund, that means I own Fidelity stock. No, it means that Fidelity has put a bunch of things together, or a John Hancock, or anybody that does a mutual fund has put a bunch of different kinds of investments in the fund so that they are automatically diversifying that. And mutual funds are run by a fund manager who usually takes a cut of what his assets or her assets are under management. So if they do well, they make more money. If they don't do well, they make less. Now, you might say, well, that sounds great. You know, they've got skin in the game. I'm going there. But a mutual fund manager really doesn't care much about your $10,000 in general. Maybe some do, but, you know, they care about the overall portfolio for which they're taking a cut, sometimes a quarter of a percent, sometimes more. And the fund may charge you, you know, a 1% fee or 1.5% management fee, something like that. There are no load mutual funds also that don't have those kinds of fees, but are way too detailed to get into right now. But for a long-term investment for somebody in their 20s or 30s, stocks, mutual funds, things of that nature may be good. Real estate might be good. If you have time to sit on it until another time when the market is better or the increase in the asset is higher and then execute a sale, then you can handle a long-term investment. If you're in your 40s or 50s, your long-term investment might be something more like an annuity or a CD or, you know, bonds or something that's a little more conservative mixed with some of those other things we talked about. And if you're at retirement age, then although you may have enough money to tolerate some losses in a stock or a mutual fund portfolio, that's a time when you might want to shift more toward something like annuities, CDs, bonds, whatever might be fairly safe in the market at that time. We talk a lot about fixed index annuities because they're a fixed product. In other words, they have guarantees, but they still have earnings linked to the market. So you don't have the downside potential that you would have with a mutual fund or stock portfolio, but you have some upside potential that can be very competitive.
Okay.
So I hope that gives him some answer.
Okay. Well, the next one you kind of touched on this one. This is from Erica in Northampton. What is the difference between an annuity and a CD? And I got this a couple times.
I just want to take this moment to say to people, I don't know these questions in advance. My favorite thing about these shows is that I never know the questions. I don't even know the categories of the questions. You just collect them. If anybody wants to write in with a question, jtyler@whmp.com, and then you spring them on me. And I love it. It's like one of my favorite things to do.
Well, okay. What's so funny too is that when I get the questions, I try to answer them in my head to see if I'm anywhere close. And I've got about a 25% win rate.
All right. You're doing pretty well. The difference between a CD and an annuity. Okay. So first of all, lots of different kinds of CDs and lots of different kinds of annuities. But in general terms, the word annuity comes from the word annual. So it's designed at some point to give you some kind of annual income. Doesn't mean you have to take income from it. You might just draw interest, or you might take your RMDs, required minimum distributions, if it's an IRA. You might make withdrawals. You might take the whole thing out at once when it's past a surrender charge period. But there are some things they have in common. So a CD and an annuity will both probably have some kind of surrender charge. Now, they may be called a penalty or a fee, but what that means is if you take the money out early, before the contract is matured, whether it's a CD or an annuity, you're probably going to suffer some kind of a penalty.
Okay.
An annuity will usually have something called a free withdrawal clause on it. So maybe per year, they're all different, but maybe per year you could take, let's say, 10% of your balance out without a penalty. You only pay the penalty on anything over that.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. An annuity by its very nature is tax deferred. A CD is not, unless it's an IRA. So one of the main differences between an annuity, there are lots, but one of the main differences between an annuity and a CD is that enjoyment of tax deferral, whether you want it or you don't, right? If you don't want your tax deferral, if you don't care, you don't mind paying taxes on your money as you earn it, a CD might be the right thing for you if it's a good fit.
Mm-hmm.
If you want to grow your money as if it were an IRA, even if it's not, then you could use an annuity to do that, because while the money is in there growing, there's no tax on it. So instead of earning a dollar and sending 30 cents to the government, you get to make money on the whole dollar, mm-hmm. which is the power of tax deferral. That's why people do IRAs. But you can't just create an IRA with, let's say, $100,000 from the sale of your house. There are rules against that.
Mm-hmm.
So if you want tax deferral on that money, an annuity might be a way to do it. Now, a CD is often designed, most CDs are pretty simple. You put the money in the bank, they pay you a certain interest rate for a period of time, done deal, like a high yield savings account would be, with the exception of an early withdrawal penalty or fee. An annuity, you can put lots of different kinds of riders on. For instance, you could put an income rider on it, depending on the product. And that might mean that at some point in the future, you can draw a lifetime income,
mm-hmm.
an income that you can't outlive, regardless of what the market does. Some annuities have bonuses up front, you know, 10, 15, 20, 30% bonus right up front on the contract. They might have other kinds of riders, like something called a first die rider. If either spouse dies, you can get out of the contract instantly without any surrender charges.
Mm-hmm.
I could go on and on and on. One of the main differences can be that an annuity avoids probate automatically. Whoever the beneficiaries are on the annuity, get the money regardless of what your will says.
Okay.
You can do something similar to that in a CD with beneficiaries, but many people never put beneficiaries on their CDs.
Going back to the tax deferral thing real quick, it seems like if you do the math, if you're doing the tax deferral and that full amount of money is growing each time, what is the benefit of not doing tax deferral? Because some people obviously must do that. Why would you want to pay the taxes now and have less money grow? Does that make sense?
It makes sense. I think that's the same argument as, do you Roth your IRA or do you not? Do you pay the taxes now or later?
Mm-hmm.
And I think the simplistic answer is, well, I'm going to pay the taxes sooner or later anyway. Why not pay them now? Or people will say, well, I'm going to be in a higher tax bracket later on, so I want to pay them now. If your taxes are going up, you know, that's what taxes do. They go up. You have to remember that you may be at retirement not in a higher tax bracket. You might be in a lower tax bracket.
Mm-hmm.
So the answer is one of, you know, accounting, really. For most people, I think the enjoyment of tax deferral can be a great thing. Now, you could also have an annuity that's a Roth IRA, you know. So there's so many different kinds. There are fixed annuities. There are fixed indexed annuities. There are variable annuities.
Mm-hmm.
The list goes on and on. The one that I will say I use only very, very sparingly and only in the case of an emergency is something called an immediate annuity. And that's the kind people seem to know the most about, where you just dump your money in and it gives you an annual stream of income and that's it. You've given up control of the money for the income. I would not recommend using that unless there's some urgent reason it has to be done.
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise, I would rather let the money grow and take it out when you need it.
Would you say that one of them, a CD or an annuity, is better for a small sum and one's better for a large sum, or would you not break it down that way?
That's a good question. It's a very good question. Many annuities have a minimum deposit of, some have 5,000, but most of them have 10,000 mm-hmm. or 25,000 minimum. So if you're somebody who's investing a few thousand dollars, then a CD might be just what you need. Also, if you need short-term liquidity, like let's say you only want to tie this money up for 6 months or a year, then a CD is a much better deal for you than most annuities, which have longer term. So As Dave asked, what's the best long-term investment? An annuity might be one of them, depending on your needs. Yeah.
Okay. We're going to get to some more questions coming up. And I want to get your phone number, though, because like you said, a lot of these questions you can generally answer, but you need some specifics to give the best advice.
Absolutely. They can reach us at 413-773-3333.
Or you can visit hugyourmoney.com. We'll be right back with part two of Financial Fitness with the Money Doctor, Dr. Francis Ram, coming up on WHMP.
Every day, financial ads claiming to be different from the competition. Are they? I'm Francis Ram, the Money Doctor, and I'm about to make a bold statement. I believe the thing to focus on isn't their uniqueness, it's yours. No one has the same financial situation or needs as you, and no one can help us help you better than you. But the truth is, when it comes to managing money, most of us are not as successful as we'd like to be. No matter how focused we are, it's almost impossible to separate emotion, and being in a relationship can further compound the issue. That's why I developed Hug Your Money. Financial coaching, coupled with online software and tools to empower you to manage money wisely. We guide you every step of the way to resolve immediate issues and plan for your financial future with modeling scenarios. So whether it's debt, budget, retirement planning, or a financial crisis, having a HUG coach in your corner is like having a new best financial friend. HUG Your Money is as unique as you are. In fact, it's patented. Visit hugyourmoney.com.
Welcome back to Financial Fitness. I'm Jess Tyler, along with the Money Doctor, Dr. Francis Ram, on one of our favorite shows. We're answering listener questions.
We are. And so Dave and Erica will both be getting a copy of the book for writing in with questions that we used on the air. So I appreciate that. And of course, I would extend to them the offer to just call me. I'll be happy to answer them more specifically. I love these shows because I never know what the questions are. And they're varied. And sometimes they involve, you know, relationships. I don't know if we have any of those questions today, but sometimes they're things like, you know, I racked up a bunch of debt and my spouse doesn't know. Mm-hmm. How do I tell them?
Yeah. All right. The next one comes from Sam in East Hampton. What are the biggest mistakes people make when investing in the stock market?
Ooh. Okay. Number one, not watching their money.
Okay.
Not watching their money. The average person invests in the stock market, usually through a broker, but even on their own, and they watch it for a little while closely, and they see it go up and down, and they get nervous, and they get happy, and all of that. But then other things take over, and they just don't log in, or they say, I got a person who watches that for me, so I don't worry about it.
Mm-hmm.
So I would say that's the number one thing, is to not look at it. I would say second would be to not diversify. People tend to fall in love with a stock, which is going to be number three, by the way. So people tend to fall in love with a stock, and they say, I want Disney because I know Disney, and Disney's always great.
Mm-hmm.
So I would say that's a big mistake, to not get a diversified portfolio that includes a number of different kinds of stocks. In other words, don't buy all tech stocks. Don't buy all oil stocks, right?
Mm-hmm.
Diversify. When the market is going up in one sector and down in another, then you can benefit from that. And I should mention, I'm not a stockbroker. So this is about the mistakes I see people make. Number three, maybe should have been the first one, but is getting emotionally attached to your stock.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you think, oh, I love this stock. I have great faith in this company, and this company's going places. And, you know, no matter whether it's sinking or swimming, you're just happy to own that stock. Be careful about that. Some of these things are worse when you're a short-term investor than they are when you're a long-term investor.
Mm-hmm.
So one of the long-term things that you can tolerate, that you can't really tolerate well as a short-term stock investor, is having an exit strategy. If you're trading short-term or buying stocks for the relatively short-term, let's say a year or less, maybe even 2 years or less, and you don't have a stop loss or a real exit strategy where you say, okay, if this goes in the other direction, I'm cutting my losses at $26.09 or whatever. You need to be very specific when you get in my opinion, to how you're getting out. Otherwise, what happens is people just hang on for the ride month after month, week after week, waiting for this stock to come back because the market always comes back, blah, blah, blah. And sometimes those stocks go, sometimes they become penniless or penny stocks, I mean. So I think you have to watch all of those things. Maybe not looking for the right advisor, just like haphazardly somebody comes to you and says, I've got some stock to invest in, you know, give me some money and I'll invest it. That wouldn't be how I would invest. Go and find a good broker who has a good reputation, get some referrals, give them a small amount of money, see how they do, stay in touch with them. But I'll tell you this one golden rule. No one will watch your money like you will.
Yeah, how true.
I don't care how nice they are. I just don't care. I mean, they're busy, right? Mm-hmm. And so a lot of the brokers have sort of these, you know, check the box. Okay, here's the portfolio we give, and it's sort of cookie cutter, and we give it to everybody. Mm-hmm. And then that's how they manage a book, because they can't manage, you know, 500 people individually. So I hope those are some of the biggest mistakes people make when they're investing in the stock market. I hope some of that is helpful.
Would you say that, Sam, when you were talking about checking it often, how much is enough and how much is obsessive? Like once a day, once a week, once a month?
Depends on the stocks.
Okay.
If you're really day trading or you're really looking at things, you might even be trading before the market opens or after the market closes and be done. If you're trading, you know, longer term, you might want to look at it, you know, once a week, once a month, once a quarter. Some people will check it every day just to get a feel. I think that's a good idea, is to learn how the stock moves. Is it moving in a channel? Is it, you know, does it spike up or down? What causes it to move, so that you can be a more informed investor? Mm-hmm. You know, gee, when gas price is up, my stock is down.
Yeah.
I should pay attention to that. Next time I see gas prices up, I should maybe check my stock, right? Those kinds of things are very, very valuable. Know what you own.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Next question. We've got this one from Lisa in Williamsburg. I've saved $1,000. Where is the best place to put it?
Good job, Lisa. Good job. I wish I knew how old she was, but I don't care. I'm just happy that she's saving. Mm-hmm. So saving $1,000, depending on what she needs it for, and I'm going to guess that this should be emergency cash reserves, and she's going to continue to save. Mm-hmm. A lot of times people will save for something. So they'll say, I'm saving it for a car or whatever, but then they don't build an emergency cash reserve.
Right.
And they end up in credit card debt because they overextended themselves. So the first thing she should do, I think, is to earmark that for emergency cash reserves and continue to save until she has whatever she considers to be a healthy emergency cash reserve. I don't abide by the you must have, you know, 6 months savings, 3 months savings, mm-hmm. Bill pay, because people can tolerate different amounts of risk. But once she's got that, or even now, a good place to put it where she would have high liquidity and still decent earnings is probably a high yield savings account or a money market account. And in this market, I just opened one for 5.55%. So you can do pretty well for short-term liquidity, money that you want to be liquid.
So don't just leave it in your savings
account. Yeah, don't just leave it in. Well, not unless your bank is paying you a good rate of interest.
Okay.
Now, you know, getting 4.5% at your local bank that you know and you're happy with, where you can, it's very convenient to move the money, might be worth that rather than getting 5.5% someplace that you don't know, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, yeah, I think she should just ask her local bank to begin with, hey, how can I make more money on this? But I would not say mutual funds or anything yet. If she doesn't have cash reserves, if all she saved is $1,000, I want her to keep working on that and keep it safe, but try to earn some money on it. At the point where she gets past emergency reserves, mm-hmm. and now she's starting to save money that she wants to invest, let's just say, for the sake of argument, she has to have $5,000 in emergency reserves. I don't know.
Okay.
When she gets past that, let's say she builds up another $4,000 or $5,000 or $10,000. That's a time to start looking for where can I actually, I would say, invest it, meaning something other than a savings. Where can I make more money on it? How can I protect it? How can I grow it further?
Okay. Yeah. My answer was under the mattress, so that's not a good spot.
Well, no. But, you know, it brings up a point. Sometimes people will keep cash in their safe at home. Mm-hmm. And this might sound silly and a little paranoid, but if you're going to put your cash in your safe, do me a favor, please put it in a Ziploc bag and then put it in the safe, because if you have a fire, and I know you've heard me say this before, if you have a fire and they come and douse your house with water, mm-hmm. the fire may not have bothered your money, but the water will.
Got it.
So if you really must put your money in a safe, please put it in a Ziploc bag. But yes, I would prefer that it's not under the mattress or in your safe. Yes.
I will say, not getting into a big thing about, you know, what is going on in the world today, but are you finding that a lot more people are keeping money at home? Like, I know two separate people that said they've got their money at home because if anything happens with the banks or online or any kind of a cyber attack, are you seeing any more of that in your business?
No, I'm not. People aren't telling me that necessarily.
So I just have crazy
but
friends.
But I do. No, I'm not crazy friends at all. I mean, I think a lot of people keep some cash on hand for a number of reasons. What if the banks are closed, if the ATM doesn't work, if you want to buy something in cash that is a big ticket item, if you don't want a paperwork trail on it, there's a whole bunch of reasons that people keep cash on hand. But I would just say that making decisions out of fear is not necessarily great. So maybe this is a short-term decision for people and they're waiting till November to find out what happens. Mm-hmm. I don't know. But this is a fear that's been going on since digital stuff was popular. You know, you used to go to the bank and get your money and the people actually handed it to you. And, you know, it wasn't really there, but they had enough money on hand to make it seem like the money was always there. And I think people are more nervous about not being able to electronically transfer or get money out. But you have to remember things like if we really had a cyber attack, mm-hmm. your gas pumps aren't working. Nothing's working. So I don't know what your cash is doing for you at that point, except if it really gets ugly, I guess then you can trade cash for other things. But boy, that's a world I'm not looking forward to if that ever happens. Yeah.
Okay. By the way, we are answering listener questions. If there is a question that you want, we're going to be doing more of these shows in the future. So you can send it in to info@hugyourmoney.com or to me here at jtyler@whmp.com. And if we use the question in the show, you're going to get a copy of the book, which is right behind you.
Oh, Retire Debt and Retire Well. It is. Yeah.
And I believe
retire sooner, live better.
Perfect. All right. Excellent. Next question is, what is my maximum debt to income ratio I can have to still qualify for a mortgage?
Oh, I like it. Who is this from?
This is from Jim, and this is from Southampton.
Great. Oh, so a little bit will depend on the bank, whether you're working with a mortgage broker or a local bank or a big box bank. But in general, I like to see it at 36% or less, which is what the banks always used to go by, right? They used to say 36%. Let's define that for people. Your debt to income ratio is your monthly payments in debt against your gross income. And so people get that confused quite a bit. That's your income before taxes and deductions.
Okay.
So if you have $100,000 a year coming in before taxes and deductions, mm-hmm. let's say you have a $100,000 salary, you can be paying no more than $36,000 out in monthly payments, okay. right, over the course of the year.
Okay.
Over the course of the year. So $3,000 a month, mm-hmm. right?
I'm doing fast math in my head as you're saying it.
$100,000 salary, $3,000 a month in debt payments would put you at a 36% debt to income ratio. I like that ratio. I like to see less than that. It's from experience of working with clients for the last 15 years, watching when they can pay their debts and still tolerate a surprise car expense and when they can't manage to buy popcorn to go to the movies. So 36% or less, I like. However, as home prices have become more expensive mm-hmm. and credit cards have eaten up more of people's salary and childcare and everything else has gone up, banks have had to become a little more aggressive about lending for mortgages. And so most banks now will lend at 42, even 43% debt to income ratio.
Okay.
So I don't love that. I know it will get you into a home and I know you'll be okay for a while, but I also know that at that level, money is tight mm-hmm. and you will not be able to tolerate surprise expenses. They will end up on credit cards. Credit cards will give you credit at, 50, 55, 60% debt to income ratio. They don't care. They're getting 29% until you default. So try not to let yourself get buried. So to qualify for a mortgage, yes, you could probably even have 42 or 43%. To be able to pay it and live a decent lifestyle, I would like you to have no more than 36% debt to income ratio.
Okay.
Yeah.
And I think we have time for one more question. This one is from Betty in Amherst, and it's kind of on the similar housing question, I would say. She says, is it smart to keep renting with the price of houses right now, or am I just throwing money away every month?
Oh, that's a hard one. Yeah, short term, you can look at it and say, no, it's not, rent is really high, but so are house prices, and I should trade in my rent for a house price. But where I think you might win the game is when house prices start to go down. Because your rent isn't going down with them. So when house prices start to go down, not unless you got some unusual landlord who said, my house is worth less money now, so I'll charge you less rent. But I've never seen that happen. Mm-hmm. So at the time when houses become more affordable, because you have to remember that renting is a short-term financial obligation and buying a house is a long-term financial obligation. Mm-hmm. So to clarify this a little bit, if you're trading in $2,000 a month in rent for $2,000 a month in a mortgage, that might seem logical right now. Oh, I'll build equity and all of that. but you are saddling yourself with that $2,000 a month in a mortgage on a long-term investment whose value may decline.
Mm-hmm.
Now, everybody thinks real estate always goes up. In general, it's on an upward trajectory, but that doesn't mean it's always up. So let's say that you trade that in. Okay, let's give you a scenario on both sides. You're renting for $2,000 a month. Something happens and you can't afford your rent any longer. What do?
You move out.
Yeah, you find a less expensive apartment. You move home with your family, whatever. You're done. There's no long-term obligation there. The landlord isn't coming after you unless you break a lease, right? I'm talking about a month-to-month rent right now. If you know, you're done. But if you're in a house and you can't afford that payment because something changes, now you're looking at foreclosure, legal costs, all of that.
Mm-hmm.
So you might say, well, I'm going to sell my house. Well, that might be a solution, but what if the market has declined
mm-hmm.
and you can't get as much money out of your house as you just paid for it a year, 2 years, 3 years ago? That's when there's a real problem. So I like there to be some wiggle room. I do approve, if I can use that word, of owning homes, right? Mm-hmm. I think you do build equity. I think you do have some security, but they also come with some expenses that you aren't considering in rent, such as taxes, real estate taxes,
mm-hmm.
and repairs,
yeah.
and homeowners insurance. So, you know, very often people do that sort of simple comparison. I'm paying this in rent. I could be paying that in a mortgage.
Right.
You could, but you might also have to consider those other expenses I'm talking about. Now, if she could wait a little bit until housing prices decline, and they will, they'll go down again, right? If she can wait till housing prices drop and tolerate her rent for the moment, then she could trade in her high rent for possibly an equal or lower mortgage mm-hmm. and use that to her advantage.
Yeah,
but in the meantime, is she throwing money out the window? Yeah, well.
Yeah, I always hear that term too. And I think that on the flip side, people feel like even with the repairs and the taxes and all that, at least you own something at the end of it versus not owning anything. But I guess it just depends what situation you're in, whether it's worth it or not.
And if you can pay for it.
Right.
You know, sometimes people get into these homes because they look good on paper right then and there.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes people even do that intentionally. Look, we both have great jobs right now. We're planning to change our jobs. We're going to make less money. Let's get that mortgage now while we can qualify.
Right.
What are you qualifying for? You're qualifying to be in over your head when you change your jobs,
mm-hmm.
you know? So be conservative when you're trying to get a mortgage, because I promise you, mortgages are long-term, you know, 20, 30 years for most people. With us, you know, they're usually about 8 or 9 years when we add in all their debt and pay it off, which it tends to change those decisions for the positive. But, you know, be conservative, because there will come a time when money gets tighter for some reason, and you need to be able to survive that. So in addition to getting a mortgage that you can afford, certainly build up cash reserves, as I think it was Erica that asked about the $1,000. Mm-hmm. Certainly build up cash reserves so that you can tolerate those kinds of expenses and surprises and expect real estate taxes to continue to go up.
All right, let's get your phone number for anyone that's got specific questions.
Thank you. It's 413-773-3333.
And you can always go to info@hugyourmoney.com. We'll be back next week with another edition of Financial Fitness with the Money Doctor, Dr. Francis Rand.
Have you heard about Get the Tea? It's an online herbal supplement company with high quality standards. You cannot find these in stores. They carry cleansing teas and targeted herbal supplements for all your health needs. Go to getthetea.com today to order yours. Health shouldn't be put off. It should be a priority. And check out their specials page for sale items. That's getthetea.com. Enter code TEA123 for 10% off exclusively for my listeners. Getthetea.com, code TEA123. Order today.
This is Frances Rayum, the Money Doctor. Now you can become 100% debt-free, budget successfully, and retire well, all under the Hug Your Money umbrella.
Like, I think back on it, and I think we have refinanced our house a lot of times. You know, we bought our house in 1988, and it's always been equity, roll it all in, kids' college, roll it all in. This is the selling point of it. Right now you're paying $1,000 a month just for your mortgage alone. If you roll it all in together, you're only going to be paying $700. And it's everything's all paid. And then we say, oh, we're going to pay extra on that. Oh, yeah. We're going to still pay $1,000 even though we only owe $7. We don't.
Debt, budget, retirement. HUG works best when we work together. Schedule your free consultation with a Hug Your Money coach today. Visit HugYourMoney.com. Hug Your Money. So unique, It's patented.
Financial literacy and the human condition. Welcome to Financial Fitness with the Money Doctor, Dr. Francis Rahm.
Welcome to Financial Fitness. I'm Jess Tyler, along with the Money Doctor, Dr. Francis Rahm. Good morning.
Well, hello, Jess. How are you?
I love our new setup where we actually get to see each other and talk to each other in the morning rather than just over the phone.
Yeah, it's nice. I think it is nicer to see people, even if it's on a screen. And of course, my schedule prevents me from driving to the station all the time and doing the show in person. But this has worked out well for us. And so I wanted to ask you if you have been doing anything on the news about Financial Literacy Month, or does anybody talk about Financial Literacy Month?
I would say that you talk about it. Yes.
Okay. Well, all right. So April is Financial Literacy Month. And Beyond Finance commissioned one poll to do a study and actually got Financial Literacy Week, Financial Practice Week.
Okay.
Added to Chase's schedule of events. Like anybody pays attention to Chase's schedule of events mm-hmm. either. But so that was just supposed to add a little more value to Financial Literacy Month. And so they had, of course, as you can imagine, a lot of boring statistics, but they do translate to how we're really feeling about our money. In other words, how do Gen Z feelers,
how do Gen Z feelers?
So how do Gen Zers feel about their money, you know, as opposed to maybe baby boomers?
Mm-hmm.
And what do we know? When we say financial literacy, what are we really talking about? So I don't know. I think, you know, financial literacy is so broad. Maybe some people think that means you have to learn how to balance a checkbook mm-hmm. or your bank statement. Nobody uses a checkbook anymore either, but a bank statement. And other people think that means they have to learn how to trade in the market. You know, so from my perspective, financial literacy, I think, I don't know, maybe we come up with a new term like, you know, don't be a scaredy cat, right? It's just financial literacy is just about sort of warming up to the idea of managing your money and understanding what some of the basic terms mean. But overall, really just understanding, like anything else you would want to know, you want to drive a car, you want to have some idea of how it runs. Do you need to be able to, you know, rebuild a transmission? No, but you need to understand, okay, when I get in this vehicle, these are my goals. I want to go from point A to point B, and I'm going to get there, and I'm going to go the long way, the short way. I'm mm-hmm. going to do it safely, whatever the analogy might be, right? So you have to have some framework, some boundary, some basic knowledge.
I feel like a quiz is coming. Am I getting a quiz?
No.
Okay.
No, you're not, actually. And that's kind of the point. Now, you just brought that up. I feel like something scary is going to happen to me if I look at my money.
Mm-hmm.
Somebody's going to quiz me on this. Okay, your relationship with money is private. It's your relationship with money. If you choose to share that with your partner or with a coach, that's up to you. And that is placing them in a place of honor and trust. So they should be able to speak to you in positive language about this. So if every time, okay, here's another analogy. People say to me, how do you get your cat to ride in the car so calmly? Because she rides everywhere with me, right?
Okay.
She loves it.
Where is this analogy going?
It's going to the vet. How many people can't round up their pet mm-hmm. when it's time to go to the vet? Now, why is that? Why is the dog or the cat in the car, you know, frothing at the mouth, hiding under the seat, clinging to the owner? Because the only time they take them anywhere is to the vet.
Mm-hmm.
And very often that's not always, I mean, most vets are pretty good, but
not
still,
a pleasant experience.
Pet, yeah. Yeah. For a pet that never goes in the car anywhere, that's not a pleasant experience. So they've associated getting in the car with having a shot or whatever. Now, that might seem like a way out there analogy, but let me tell you, it's a lot closer than you think. If every time you look at your money, it's because you're doing it, oh, something awful has just happened, I better sit down and look at my money.
Mm-hmm.
It's all the bad stuff's already happened to you. And the result is you have to now bother to look at your money and you're probably not going to do it very well, right? You don't feel good about it, all of that.
Mm-hmm.
So just to give you some idea of this, what this lack of confidence in money translates to in the numbers, according to this poll anyway, is that only two in five people consider themselves more financially savvy than others.
Mm-hmm.
That means 3 out of 5 people think they know less than their neighbor or their friend or their partner. 3 out of 5 people are going, oh, I'm not very good with money.
That seems accurate.
Right?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. 39% admit that they procrastinate.
Mm-hmm.
Well, go figure. Wouldn't you?
Yeah.
I mean, if every time you look at this, you get a bad result, it's going to get worse.
Mm-hmm.
Instead, you need to build some positive things that will help you get over these hurdles. They need to be little, but you can do it. So we're talking about healthy financial habits.
Mm-hmm.
When we talk about Gen Zers, right? Generation Z is the most likely to procrastinate at about 49%. With baby boomers, no surprise, the least likely to procrastinate at 22%.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you can come up with all kinds of social parameters as to why this happens. I'm going to say baby boomers have had more practice at it.
Mm-hmm.
Good, bad, or otherwise, they've had more practice at it. They've had more time to hone their skills. They've learned how to do the kinds of things we can talk about so that they're not quite so afraid and they don't procrastinate quite so much. I don't think it's that they're, you know, just better doers. It's not like they all grew up on the Nike do it now thing, right? It's just everybody procrastinates when it's something you don't want to do.
Yeah.
So let's talk about that one little thing for just a minute. How do you get around procrastinating? Now, I have a little sign on my desk. I can't reach it from here, but it says the top 10 reasons I procrastinate. One, period. Thank you. Yes. And I've used it over the years as sort of a gauge of how tightly somebody is wrapped when they're in my office about their finances. In other words, if they look at it, because they usually do, they'll like, you know, glance over at that sign and they're talking to me and they look at the sign, they talk and they look at the sign. If they start to laugh right away, then I know, okay, this is easy. These people have a sense of humor about their money.
Mm-hmm.
They're going to be okay. But most of the time people will look at it and they won't laugh until about halfway through the meeting or at the end of the meeting. And I know that that's because they're just not processing it. They're having a quiz.
Mm-hmm.
Top 10 reasons I procrastinate. What's she going to ask me? What's number two? I don't know.
Right, you know? Right. Yeah. For me with the quiz, I was thinking like the terms, because I will say since we started doing the show together, when we first started, like I didn't really know the difference between an annuity and a CD. So there are so many terms with finances.
Oh, yeah.
So that's what I was thinking along the lines of a literacy quiz.
Yeah, it's financial jargon. This stat actually surprised me. 40% of Americans have no idea what a 401k is.
Mm.
Now, that's a pretty vague comment, but that's how it was listed in the article. I think, you know, they probably don't know how it works.
Mm-hmm.
They've heard of them. They've heard of them. They may not have one. 40%. I would have thought, okay, everybody knows what a 401k is.
Right.
But I'll tell you, there are so many plans. You can have a 401k, a 457, a 403b, a 401a. You can have a self-directed IRA. I mean, the list goes on and on, a solo 401k, whatever. You can have all kinds of plans that sound like they work like a 401k, but they all have their own little rules.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So what do I always tell you? I always tell you how to fix it, right? So these are all the things we're afraid of, cause us to procrastinate, feel like we're not as good at money as somebody else that we know, hide it from our partner, whatever. I think there was something like, I'll give you the stat when we come back, but something like more than half of the people said that finances have a negative effect on their relationship.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it works its way into there too. So one of the things you can do is don't pick the thing you're the most frightened of. Right. Let's not whack it with a club. Let's just poke it a little with a stick.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah.
Pick something that's a little scary. Like, oh, I don't know. I don't open my mail. All right. Now,
right.
For some people, I don't open my mail is the scariest thing. And for others, it's just like, you know, I could probably get better at that.
Mm-hmm.
I could probably fix that. And so I'll take that one item. Here's what you do. If you're afraid to go to the mailbox and open your mail, maybe you don't do it every day. Maybe you do it every couple of days,
mm-hmm.
right? But come up with a plan that is comfortable for you. And then here's my rule. Touch it once. Don't open it up, put it to the side, decide you'll look at it later, push it around your desk, come back a week later, because you know what's going to happen? That thing you were afraid of will happen.
Mm-hmm.
The fact that you are afraid that you are going to have a late fee or a delinquency notice, the longer you wait, the more likely that is to happen. So this is like ripping off the Band-Aid,
mm-hmm.
okay? If you're afraid to get your mail, decide, I'm going to get it three times a week, Monday, Wednesday, Saturday, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Do that and do it at a time when you can say, okay, I'm going to get the mail. Maybe you have to put a little special thing on your desk to remind you or whatever, or some treat yourself to some happy thing. I'm going to get the mail after I have my coffee and biscotti, whatever it is, coffee and Cheerios, I don't care. But decide you're going to get the mail and then bring it in. Sit in a place that feels good to you. Don't make it so miserable. Don't, you know, we do these awful things to ourselves, Jess, not just about finance, about everything, you know?
Yeah, the anticipation and the dread kind of builds up, and that's worse than probably the actual thing.
It is. And so, you know, just, and take this in small bites. Say to yourself, I'm going to try this for 2 weeks and see how it goes. I'm just going to promise myself I'm going to do this small thing for 2 weeks and see how it goes. And if I'm doing well, if it feels good and that improved it, then I'm going to pick the next thing.
Yeah.
And we can talk about what some of the next things are. But don't start off by saying, I have to figure out my retirement.
That's kind of a big bite to chomp off.
Yeah. Do it in little bits so that you work up your, it's the same thing as, so I'm a vocalist, right? Mm-hmm. And people always say to me, well, you don't look nervous on stage. Yeah, I don't. First of all, you know, I started off doing it when I was nervous, but I would kind of fake my way through it. And I knew I was nervous, but maybe other people didn't. Mm-hmm. But the only way to get by that is to do it over and over and over again. And believe me, it's painful for a while, but then it starts to get to be fun, actually fun. If you can imagine going to your mailbox, getting your mail and actually not being miserable about it, actually having fun, then believe it or not, you can get there.
Yeah. Because if you're going and you're expecting a late fee, I don't think that's ever going to be fun. But I guess if you do it often enough, get on top of it, you won't have late fees.
Well, that's true. And you know what? You might have a late fee. But what's going to change if you don't get your mail? Is it going to get better on its own?
I think
who's going to do those dishes?
Yeah. I think you just push it out of your mind. Like, I don't have to deal with it today, but I'll handle it tomorrow. And then tomorrow and tomorrow, it gets really easy to put it off.
And usually what happens is when people are doing that, they're rewarding themselves in other ways to make themselves feel better. Mm-hmm. So they say, I know that mailbox is ugly. I don't want to go there. I'll deal with it tomorrow. Today, I'm going to go get a latte, you know, and it just makes things worse. So I know you don't want to do it. I mean, nobody wants to, you know, go to the dentist or what. Nobody wants to do these things, but leaving them undone is worse. And I promise you, if you will just do some of these small things a little bit at a time and just give yourself a gut check, I don't care if you keep a diary. Okay. Day one, it was really hard to go to the mailbox. Mm-hmm. Day two, it was hard, but I did it. Day three, maybe I procrastinated. I didn't do it at all. Shame on me. I'll get back on it the next day. And the next day you get it and you say, I actually did this. I went to the mailbox. I opened it up. Yeah, the news wasn't great, but at least I knew it.
Yeah.
The fear of the unknown is much worse than whatever's in your mailbox. And if you have something really scary in your mailbox, call us and we'll help you with it. Even if it's not scary, we'll help you with it, right? But the fear of the unknown is always worse than the actual act.
We're going to talk more about this coming up, but I do want to get your phone number.
Sure. You can reach us at 413-773-3333.
Or you can go to hugyourmoney.com. We'll be back with part two of Financial Fitness with the Money Doctor, Dr. Francis Ram, right here on WHMP.
When it comes to investing, we're taught the higher the risk, the better the reward. Francis Ram, the Money Doctor, says it isn't necessarily true. We need to remember that with risk comes the potential for losses, and making up losses can set us back or worse, delay our retirement. You've heard the testimonials for years about how her patented program helps people become 100% debt-free far ahead of schedule. But did you know that for more than 35 years, Dr. Ram has been helping people retire well without unnecessary risk? Dr. Ram says most people mistakenly accept that in order to earn attractive interest rates, they must tolerate risk, and that choosing safety means settling for lackluster returns. But it doesn't have to be that way. You can earn competitive rates and minimize taxes without risking a single dollar of your hard-earned savings. Contact the Money Doctor at Hug Your Money for a free consultation. Call 413-773-3333 or visit hugyourmoney.com.
Welcome back to Financial Fitness. I'm Jess Tyler along with the Money Doctor, Dr. Francis Ram. Hi.
Hi. I promised you a stat when we came back about relationships.
Okay, let's hear.
So 39% admit that finances have a negative effect on their relationship. Mm-hmm. And 63% agreed that learning it together could vastly improve. their relationship.
Yeah.
Learning about finances together.
That makes sense because I don't think anybody comes into a relationship with perfectly aligned thoughts on money. You know, there's the people that are like, one's a spender, one's a saver. That's horrible. But even the ones that are on the same wavelength, I'm sure there's a few things they disagree on.
Oh, you think?
You deal with this every day.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, just when I think I've heard every story, I get another one. But sometimes people will call me and I always say I want to see both people together, unless there's some extenuating circumstance. Right. And sometimes people will kind of hedge around it like, well, you know, my husband works a lot or my wife is, it's really hard for her to come to an appointment. And eventually they might tell me why. Mm-hmm. And it could be anything from, look, we're really fighting about it and that's unpleasant. And I just have to get my head together before I can do this as a couple.
Right.
To, I think I'm leaving my spouse and I need to know how my finances will play out. What can I learn? You know, because I'm afraid I won't be able to land on my feet, or my spouse is leaving me, or even, geez, I racked up a bunch of credit card debt and I never told my partner. And now it's really coming due. Yeah. So you hear things like that, but other times it's just things like, well, I really want to retire and I think I have enough money to do it, but my wife wants me to keep working or my husband wants me to keep working or my partner says I'm going to retire and die and I don't want to have that conversation. I just want to retire, you know, and there are lots of reasons why it's difficult for couples to discuss this stuff. But I will tell you that it gets much easier when you involve an objective third party financial coach. I will give you tough love if I think you need it, but I use it pretty sparingly.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I've had couples where, you know, one of them is verbally abusive to the other in front of me in the meeting.
That's
awkward.
I've
had to say, okay, I'm sorry, but you can't do that here.
Yeah.
You know, this is my turf, my rules, you know, I think what you mean to say is,
yeah,
or a better way to say that might be, or let me paraphrase if I understand what's going on here. And so you can iron it out, but a lot of times people are really pretty abusive, even subtly verbally abusive, like, and to themselves. I can't tell you the number of times I've had to say to people, okay, let's change your conversation you're having with yourself about money, because I'm saying, well, let's do this. Oh, I'm really bad at that. And I have to say, no, you used to be really bad at that, but now you're trying to change.
Yeah.
Now you're trying to get better at it. So now you say to yourself, wow, okay, what does a new self do with money? The new self says, I sit down and I work on this thing, right?
Yeah.
The old self says, I'm really bad at that and I ignore it. And people pick that up. They really do. The 35%, going back to my stats here, don't know what interest is in a financial context. I'm astonished that people answered that way, but they did. 30% didn't think they could win a game of financial trivia. I thought that was low. I think a lot more people than that would say, I'm not winning a game of financial trivia, depending on how hard it was.
Yeah.
Yeah. So there's this overall lack of confidence. So the top reasons for procrastinating, 25% said, all together now, stress. Right. And 16% said, I don't look at it because I don't think it can get any worse. So who cares? Right. And then 13% just say, I don't know. I forget to do it. It's just forgetfulness. That's not 100%. So we don't know what the rest of them say
they couldn't bother to fill out the list. That's what happened.
Yeah. Maybe. Yeah.
They could. They procrastinated too much.
They're still working on it. It'll get done someday.
The deadline came and went, but they didn't even see it.
I love it. Oh boy. Let's see. The average American checks their banking app twice a day. Yet 50% say they're nervous when they open their banking app. You talk about a slow torture. Let me get this straight. You're really nervous when you open your banking app, but you're doing it twice a day. And you won't go get your mail? Yeah. Pick the less scary thing and do that. Okay.
Right.
If the less scary thing is to start a jar and throw coins into it, start there. But pick something you have a little fear of. Don't say, well, okay, like for New Year's resolutions, I said I was going to gain weight and stop smoking.
Things you wanted to do.
Well, I never smoked. So that was really easy to me. And gaining weight was probably an inevitable. So I said, those are the two things I'll do for New Year's resolutions.
Yeah.
Okay. So be tougher on yourself than I was. Yeah. Generation Z, most uncomfortable at opening their banking app, 65%. And baby boomers, 26%. Yet they're opening it twice a day on average. What that tells me is they're really worried about their balances or what's going on with their banking app, right? And it also tells me the banking industry has been able to gamify your money a bit in a way that's causing people to look at it all the time.
Right.
When it comes to budgeting, that terrible word, that awful word that nobody wants to do, which is why we don't ask people to build a budget. We ask them to track their expenses and then we help with the budget, right? Because a budget shouldn't be this little box that you have to live in. It should be a flexible, fluid thing. But when it comes to budgeting, here's my point, 81%, both baby boomers and millennials try to make a budget. They try to limit themselves on their spending. 81% give it their best shot. 34% fail at it. Only 66% stick to it on average. So baby boomers stick about 76% of the time, with Generation Zers at about 42%.
Yeah, so, I wonder how much it is of whether they stick to it or whether, as we've talked about on a bunch of shows, prices are so high now that what you're bringing in isn't covering your expenses, and that's why you're not sticking to it. Not, you know, from going out and spending a bunch of money on other things.
Well, that is actually the point of having a budget that is flexible. Because when prices go up, rather than saying, oh my gosh, I can't stick to my budget, which was a rigid number I put down the bottom line when I got it done once and for all, I checked the box, right? Rather than doing that, as the prices are going up, if you're tracking your expenses, you start to see it and you say, oh geez, I had a $100 deficit this month. Prices are going up. Where am I going to make up for that?
Yeah.
Instead of landing someplace where you say, well, I have $5,000 on a credit card because prices went up and I couldn't afford it. You know, whenever I don't really care what went on somebody's credit card. You know, when they come to see me or we have a Zoom meeting, they always think I'm going to be really judgmental. And they try to tell me right away, well, I only have this credit card because I was going just fine. And then, you know, there's always this long explanation. And I sort of cut them off like, okay, unless it's from an obsessive shopping disorder, compulsive shopping disorder, or unless it's from something that's going to continue, then I just call it so what? It's just, I mean, of course you have this stuff.
I think that is a fear, though, like you were saying, it's with any professional. Like when you go into a dentist, you don't want to tell them how much you're going to you feel like you're going to get lectured.
No, there's no point. It's not fruitful and it certainly doesn't feel good and it won't get the result we're looking for, which is for people to warm up to the idea of, hey, I can do this. This isn't it. You know what the real shame is? I remember in the fourth grade, we had a teacher that taught us how to write a check. And I remember going home and telling my mother, the teacher taught us how to write a check today. And they thought that was the strangest thing, you know, like in the fourth grade, they taught you how to write a check. Because it was a math teacher. And so she used that as a way to teach us how to balance a check statement, a checking account. Now, in the fourth grade, we could balance a checking account because it's addition and subtraction. It wasn't that hard, right? So that became not a scary thing to me in my life. But we don't give kids this any longer.
I'm curious.
We don't give adults this.
I'm curious with literacy. It's literacy month for April, you said, right? Did they do anything in the schools with that? Do you know?
Some schools do. Some schools really will do that. But I think it's a little too late. Better than never. But so there's a great example of how technology can help us a lot and it can also hinder us. So a lot of people don't have to balance a checkbook anymore. Because they get an e-statement. They import it into QuickBooks and QuickBooks, they go click, 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 click. Oh, look, I'm off somewhere. Oh, I'll just make an adjustment and move on. Or they go find it, but they don't really have to understand why it's happening. Whereas, you know, when you used to do it on ledger sheets and things like that, it was very helpful. So I think we are missing some basic things. You know, when it comes to saving money, for instance, you know, how do we teach kids how to save? And there's a whole chapter of this about this in the book about having them split it into four pieces so that they can get replaced later on with things like taxes, right? And so you can learn about that. But so in this survey, 53% save money by buying on sale items. Now, this reminds me of the comedian who said, my wife saves me money buying stuff. Honey, look at these great towels I bought that we didn't need. I saved $50 buying them, you know? So I love that 53% save money by buying on sale items. Now I understand what they mean, but still that can get out of hand. 47% by using coupons or discount codes, 45% by limiting spending on clothing, 42% by shopping at discount stores. then people got serious about it and said, many people get more drastic, and they say they limit their social outings to bars and restaurants at 39%. And at 36%, they limit travel or they don't travel at all.
Mm-hmm.
These are areas that people expect me to tell them when we're working on things. You can't do that.
Right.
I don't want you to take a vacation. I just can't say it enough. It isn't useful. It isn't going to work. If I tell you not to take a vacation, first of all, you won't do any of the things I'm asking you to do because you'll take the vacation instead.
Yeah.
And secondly, I haven't really helped you
mm-hmm.
manage your finance. Managing money means finding a way to have enough money to make those payments, whether it's the monthly payments that come in or whether it's overcharge fees that you're getting on your checking account,
mm-hmm.
being able to correct that so you don't get them in the future, buying a car, taking a vacation. These are all real life things. And every time I ask somebody to do a budget, they often will come back and say, well, you know, we did the month, but it wasn't real life because we took a vacation. It wasn't real life because it was the holidays.
Mm-hmm.
You're never going to have a holiday or take a vacation again?
Yeah.
That is real. We just need to divide the expense by 12 or 6 or 3 or however often you have those expenses.
Mm-hmm.
The closing thoughts on this really is we can do this together. You can do it alone if you want to, but it's harder.
Yeah.
But it's just a matter of taking a step at a time, and you don't have to go sign up for a course in macroeconomics. Right. You just have to say, I need to learn how other people have done this.
Mm-hmm.
What works for them? Because the person with a lot of money telling you how to manage your money when you have none,
it's not going to work.
It's not going to happen.
I will say too, if you're with a couple too, where you can be telling your spouse one thing and they're not hearing you, but if they go to a separate person like you, you could say the same exact thing and they're going to hear it.
Yeah, it's true. It may be that I say it in a different way. It may be that I have the credentials and the mm-hmm. trust to get that point across. But also, I tend not to muddy the waters with a lot of other stuff. That's the point of working with a coach. You're not patching a tire. You're wanting to get something that you can use that is flexible, mm-hmm. that grows with you. And the more you work it, the more it works for you.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why, you know, we handle the debt, the budget, the retirement planning, all in one place, so that you don't have to feel overwhelmed by it. We just take it a step at a time, depending on where your starting point is.
Mm-hmm.
And then we go from there. Yeah.
Well, how can people get a hold of you?
Well, they can reach us at 413-773-3333 or visit us on the web, of course, at hugyourmoney.com. And you promised me more questions. Do we have a question show coming up?
Yes.
Questions?
Maybe we'll do it next week. Yeah, I love the question shows because, as we say, you know none of the questions ahead of time, so you just kind of get them thrown at you.
I always love that. And people write really interesting questions, sometimes
yeah.
very complex, sometimes simple.
All right, that is awesome. So look forward to that next Saturday right here on Financial Fitness with the Money Doctor, Dr. Francis Ram on WHMP.
Have you heard about Get the Tea? It's an online herbal supplement company with high quality standards. You cannot find these in stores. They carry cleansing teas and targeted herbal supplements for all your health needs. Go to GetTheTea.com today to order yours. Health shouldn't be put off. It should be a priority. And check out their specials page for sale items. That's GetTheTea.com. Enter code TEA123 for 10% off exclusively for my listeners. GetTheTea.com, code TEA123. Order today.
This is Frances Rayum, the Money Doctor. Now you can become 100% debt-free, budget successfully, and retire well, all under the Hug Your Money umbrella.
Oh, I was a mess when I started. I was confused. I didn't know where to start. I had no direction. I thought it was about refinancing and putting all my debt together, but it's not. And seeing the plan, I thought, oh my gosh, I can do this. I'm so comfortable with where my finances are going and confident. I'm decreasing my debt, I'm increasing my income, and seeing the plan was the motivation to pull it all together.
Hug works best when we work together. Schedule your free consultation with a Hug Your Money coach today. Visit hugyourmoney.com. Hug Your Money. So unique, it's patented.